Hello again, and welcome back to Pirate Radio. In this episode, I speak to a gentleman called Hamish Muir, who's probably best known for his work with an agency called 8VO that did a lot of their most prominent work in the 90s. They did a lot of work with Factory Records, who's been referenced a lot over the course of this podcast. I've interviewed a couple of people that were linked into that. And I think if you don't know Hamish, I'd go and Google, because we talk a lot about his actual work, the look of the work in this. And I think if you haven't heard of him before, or you haven't heard of 8VO before, I'd advise Googling 8VO, and just so you know vaguely what we're talking about when we're discussing things. I'm a huge fan of 8VO. In the room that I'm sat in currently, I've got a number of posters that I'm sure Hamish had a role in designing. I didn't really ask him when we were talking. They're all sort of scattered around me. But yeah, I adore what they do, or what they did, I guess. And yeah, we talk a lot about his approach to design, and the way that he goes into things, as the way that he does things isn't necessarily the way that a lot of people do things, in terms of when you think about getting a brief and tackling a brief. There's sort of steps you may go through from, you know, mood boarding, research. Hamish doesn't like doing any of that. He has his own way of doing things, and we talk about that a lot in this podcast. But yeah, I hope you enjoy.
Hello, just a quick little thing. As I'm editing this, I've realised that the audio sounds horrendous, and I don't know why that is. I need to stop using the website that I use to record these, because it never fucking works and it breaks. But so the bits where I'm talking, it sounds very tinny. And I think it's just because it switched the microphone that I normally use to a different one or something. But I understand if you're listening to this and you think I'm just going to dip, that's fine, I get that. I don't talk very much when I do these anyway, so I don't think it should be that much of a problem. But yeah, just a fair warning that I don't sound very good.
Okay.
Yeah, so for the people that may be listening to this, who don't know yourself and not familiar with yourself, could you give them a little bit of a rundown as to maybe who you are and what you do?
My name is Hamish Muir. I was a founding partner, co-founder of 8VO, which officially formed as a entity, as it were, in 1985, and that was with Simon Johnston and Mark Holt, who had been working together kind of informally for about a year before that, doing some work for Factory Records as 8VO. And then more recently, 8VO closed in 2001, and in 2009, I co-founded Muir McNeil with Paul McNeil, who I was teaching with at the time at the LCC, and we were both interested in similar things to do with design systems and modular fonts and so on. So that's how Muir McNeil started, and that's still going.
Jumping backward from that a bit, so is design something that you've been interested in from sort of a young age, or is it something that you got interested in a little bit later on?
No, not at all. In fact, I didn't do any art lessons at secondary school. And in sort of sixth form, I was doing science A-levels. And about halfway through the sixth form, I realised that I was never going to be a scientist because I was really crap at maths. And so I was in a bit of a fix, really. But my interest or hobby at the time, I suppose, was photography. So I thought, well, I'd like to be a photographer. So I applied to some photography courses and was told that I needed to do a foundation course first. So I applied to Bournemouth and Poole College of Art and got into their foundation. And it was quite a, I was very lucky in that I realized after about 3 or 4 months that I had nothing to unlearn. And foundation courses in those days were about sort of trying to disavow students of all the bad habits that they picked up in GCSE and A-level art lessons, And I suddenly realized that, you know, because I had nothing to lose, all I had to do was listen and take on board what was on offer. And very quickly, I discovered, I suppose, an interest in graphic design. So I, applied for a BA course, and that's where it all started.
So yeah, as I've mentioned in the email, I'm a huge fan of your work. I don't know if you can see that because of the quality of the image, but I've got AVO posters all around me from, I brought them from Mark. But when I'm trying to find work that's in a similar style to the work you did at AVO, I can't really find any that sort of hits the exact same things that you did. And there's obviously sort of Swiss style that you can find and things like that. And there's a design aesthetic called Y2K, which is popular in sort of the early 2000s. I think it kind of maybe fits in. But if you were to describe your own work fitting in one of these sort of design canons, I guess, which one would you put it in, I suppose?
Well, I don't think it has a label really, in that the reason that we got together as AVO in 1985 was... Well, we all shared an interest in, I mean, Mark and Simon particularly were very interested in design, in the history of graphic design, you know, from the early 20th century to the then current period. And they were avid kind of collectors of printed matter, and they'd spend their kind of lunch times while they were both freelancing at Conran Design Associates in 1984, sort of combing the bookshops of Charing Cross Road. And I suppose as well, the other thing about the three of us was that we'd all had some time outside the UK. So Mark had been freelance in San Francisco for, I think, 4 or 5 years since graduating from art school. His brother was an architect in San Francisco, so he kind of wanted to get away from the north of England and go to California. And so Mark was sort of, you know, had outside of the UK influence and, or experience rather. And Simon and I had both been students at the Basel School of Design with Armin Hoffman and Wolfgang Weingart and Kurt Howard and Andre Gertler and people like that. Simon and I had both studied at Bath Academy of Art. And although we were a year or 2 years apart, I can never remember which. 1980-81, I went to Basel for a year, and Simon went from 81 to 82. So when we kind of re-met in sort of 1985, Simon was already working with Mark, and it happened in a pub, really, you know, just over a few beers, talking about graphic design and the awful state of things as we saw it in the UK at the time, where it was partly to do with, you know, the kind of politics of privatization and yuppiedom and all that kind of stuff. And not that we were very political, but British design had always had a kind of a reputation for being ideas led, and, you know, where wit and clever copywriting was possibly more important than the visual side of things. And I suppose our influences were in European typography, basically, which I think operated in a very different environment, because communication in Europe often had to, it wasn't as insular as, you know, the island of Great Britain, or rather the island of Britain, in that things had to work across borders, you know, France, Italy, Spain, Germany, and so on. And I guess European graphic design was much more rigorous in terms of its approach to a kind of systematic and methodological approach to typography as being kind of like the core of graphic design and visual communication. So that's kind of where we started. So one, we were really into typography first, and almost at, you know, to the complete exclusion of using images. So for us, it was the typography that was the thing. And the other thing was that what we were doing at the time in 1985, 86, 87, 88 was so radically different to all the other stuff that was being done in London, which, as I said, was still very ideas-led and, you know, witty and clever and DNADE and so on. So it was easy to do something different because there was no one else really doing it. I'm not saying that we were the only people using typography in London at the time, but I suppose of our generation, we were. I mean, there were older, well, particularly with that kind of European influence and sensibility, I suppose. I suppose most of 8VO's work, which was influential, was produced before whenever Y2K is, long before, you know. I mean, we kind of, you know, by the end of the 80s, we'd sort of evolved, I think, our own way of working within that kind of approach, you know, using type first. And our work developed over the 90s. But the last kind of creative job we did, I suppose, if creative is the right word, or the last sort of public piece of graphic design we did was in 1999. So we actually stopped operating before 2000. For us, it was great because we were literally working in a vacuum. And I think it's always easier to work when you're not seeing a lot of similar stuff being produced by your contemporaries at the same time.
Do you think it's sort of more difficult to do that type of thing nowadays, given the fact that it's sort of everything is oversaturated and everything is available constantly?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting question and a very interesting point. And I think you're right, or it is very hard now, because it's very hard not to be connected and not to see things and not to think, ooh, maybe I could do that, or I like that sort of approach, maybe I could. Just flipping back a little bit, when I taught, which I gave up 3 years ago, part of the whole kind of process of students responding to project briefs involved so-called research, which was often, you know, like making mood boards and stuff, although they weren't called mood boards, but that's sort of referencing, visual referencing of other things as a starting point. I mean, that scares me to death because I just think it's almost impossible to work if you've got all this stuff around you and you're trying to find a place somewhere in there which is slightly different where you can operate, you know? So, I mean, when I was at art school, the place I was in Corsham in Wiltshire, and it was a strange campus because Bath Academy of Art removed itself from Bath during the Second World War. I think maybe it was to do with, I don't think Bath was bombed heavily, but I think perhaps it was a stray Luftwaffe plane had dropped a bomb on Bath and it happened to hit the art school. Or for whatever reason, it relocated to Corsham. And I don't know what the tale was, but Corsham Court is an Elizabethan mansion in masses of grounds with peacocks on the lawn. And that's not where the studios were. They were actually located in a different place in the village, in an old army camp in Nissen huts. So the library was in the court, and it wasn't accessible unless you got on your bike and went down there from the studios. And I remember in my first year, I went to the library and I was looking at the graphic design books, and I pulled Graphis Diagrams down off the shelf, which was the original, I think, like I think it was first published in 69 or 71 or something. And I looked at this thing and I thought, this is the most amazingly sophisticated and intelligent work I have ever seen in my life. I want to give up now, you know, because if this is what being a graphic designer is, I just don't stand a hope in hell. And so I closed the book, put it back on the shelf and said to myself, I'm not going to look at any more graphic design books while I'm at art school. I'm kind of, you know, I'm not saying I don't have books and I don't look at them, but I, coming back to your point, I find I try and avoid being oversaturated. I try not to look as much as I could at things. So I don't know how, and of course, back in 85, 86, there was no internet. Obviously, there was no there's no email, there were no mobile phones really, apart from those huge kind of brick-like things that people used to have in their cars. So it was, I think the difference was, if you wanted to see something, it was an active thing. You had to seek something out. But nowadays, you're just bombarded by this shit all the time. And it's very difficult to escape from it. So I think some kind of, I think filtering is a good idea, and not looking as much, you know, just saying, well, I don't need to look to be a designer, because all I need is, I need the problem in front of me. You know, I need the brief, I need the context, I need the audience, I need the media in which this piece of communication is going to be delivered. And all of those things can frame a starting point to building a piece of visual communication. And the idea that you start by saying, well, I want to make it look a bit like that and a bit like that, because that's kind of current and trendy, to me is a bit, I think that's it's an impossible thing to do. And, but everybody works in different ways. It just, you know, I couldn't operate with being oversaturated.
Sorry to delve a little deeper in that, because I guess I understand where you're coming from, and I think that's a lovely way of working, but I think it's because I've gone through the education system and, you know, research is built into it. My brain can't even begin to wrap around what you're saying, in a sense. So if I was to set you a brief to design a poster, does all the information, so everything, the visual outcome for that, would that be just based on the brief? There would be nothing outside of that that you would take inspiration from or anything like that?
Well, it depends what the poster's for, I suppose, who it's for, why. But, I mean, typically it would be starting with the words and what they suggest in terms of some kind of typographic form. And obviously, you know, subject might suggest some particular kind of direction, but I think it's not about making something look like something or look like the idea of something. All it has to do is not contradict the thing it's about, and maybe to suggest the thing it's about in quite subtle ways. So that could be to do with, well, it's usually to do with a combination of color and form and the use of space, you know. But in a way, when creating a poster, you're not making a picture of something, you're making a something. And it's a standalone object in its own right, and its job is to tell somebody something. And it doesn't have to show the something it's talking about necessarily. So, and I think what that does is it sort of starts to make the frame within which you're working much smaller. And so therefore you've already closed down a lot of things that could be relevant, but you've deliberately decided not to even consider them. So the place that you're working in is quite defined. But what that does allow you to do, it allows you to explore in depth rather than breadth. And I think that's where things start to get interesting, because if you imagine the landscape of possibilities as being planar, horizontal, you can look and you can see things on the horizon that you might want to go towards. But if you say, well, okay, my horizons are actually quite small, but there's this other plane, which is digging down or discovery, then once you start the process of form building and form modulation, you've got more chance of discovering something rather than inventing it. And to me, that's the really important thing, because design is a process of discovery, or graphic design is, I mean, for me, and, you know, Paul McNeil would, you know, we think in the same way about that. We try to not have external ideas which influence the starting point, but just to use, you know, some kind of, you need something to shape it, but that can come from the brief, or it can come from the media, or, you know, the budget, or the number of colours you can use, or whatever. You know, there's a lot of information there at the start.
Yeah.
And then even if there isn't, you know, if it's a completely open brief and you can do what the hell you want, I mean, those are the most scary ones. The trick is to make your own, define your own limitations, you know, write a brief for yourself.
I'm doing that currently in my final year. on kind of the back of that, and I know I'm kind of laboring on it now, but this is one I wrote in the email, so it is in here, I promise. That way of approaching design isn't sort of the normal way. It sounds horrible to describe that. I don't mean it in a negative sense, of course. I think it's the way that you do it is wonderful. But if I was to talk to a client in that sense, they'd throw me out the door almost, you know what I mean? And so I just wanted to know, when you've been talking to a client, say a client has come with you with a brief and you've spoken to them in this sense, do you have struggle explaining it to them, given that they may not have kind of the graphical nuance in their brain to kind of understand where you're coming from almost?
Well, I think it depends very much on the client and why they've come to you. Mostly, you know, the 8VO work, people knew that they were hiring 8VO, and depending upon the client, like with factory, there was never a brief. They never wanted to see anything, you know, until there were printed proofs of the record packaging in their office. And only once did that not work, when Vinny got very upset by the fact that we hadn't used a portrait of him big on the front cover of an album. But I think generally, well, yeah, I mean, it's different when you're starting out, I guess, because, not necessarily. I think there are set ways of working in the industry, I suppose, and I think it's to do with defining a kind of a common ground for clients to be able to brief people within, so that the clients and the designers, through culture and habit, have agreed on a process of working. And I don't think it's the only one, you know. I mean, I don't think you need to, you don't need to produce mood boards, for example, or, but I mean, I can't really, I mean, to be honest, it's a long time since I had a brief which would require that way of working, because it's either been a specific thing like designing a book, for example. Again, an object, it's a thing, it's a we don't have to argue, we don't have to, well, you can have a discussion about what a book is, but it's not as if it's like, I'm running out of things to say about the book, but, and it's probably a bad example, but yeah, I mean, also a lot of the work that, well, Mew McNeil have done, in fact, the only commissioned work that we've done has been on the back of our kind of self-initiated work and people coming to us because they see something about our approach that they are very interested in and are happy to give us almost like the APO free rein. Here's the brief, do it. And obviously there's communication along the way and dialogue and showing things and development and so on. We wouldn't, you know, I don't think you can just, you can't play the factory game in reality. But I think it's, so it's a bit difficult for me to give you a kind of comparative answer because I haven't really had to work.
Would you
in
call
this
yourself lucky in a sense that you've never had that? Because they're obviously on the exact opposite end of the spectrum. There will be graphic design jobs where it's like it's very specific. You come in, you hate your job, and you do X, Y, and Z over and over and over again for clients that you hate and so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, I've never hated my job, and I don't think it's a job. It's more of an affliction or a disease or I don't know, a vocation, or which can sometimes be a bit of a problem because it's difficult to switch off, you know.
I get that. I'm like obsessed with it.
Well, I think you kind of, in a way, if you want to do anything good, you've kind of got to be committed to it. And with anything in quotes creative, I think that does require well, it shouldn't do, should it? But I think it probably does require a bit of a sacrifice, you know. But then, you know, who would want to work for 45 years at a job one hated and just wait for retirement, you know? I mean, to me, the concept of retirement is just, fuck, what am I going to do? You know, I don't know. I've got no hobbies, got no interests, got nothing else I'd rather do. Well, I mean, normal things like meet family and friends and go out for meals, go to the cinema, theatre, concerts, that kind of stuff. But, you know, there's nothing I can't wait to start doing instead of graphic design, you know? So, yeah. So lucky or unlucky, I don't know. I think it's just how you end up, you know. It's maybe to do with personality as well, you know. I'm not saying it's a healthy approach. In fact, I don't think it is in some ways. I think it's very, it can be very, I don't think I've found the right balance, actually. And the only thing that I would counsel is don't get too obsessed and don't let it take over your life too much. I think it's, don't know. But I never played a musical instrument, for example. I was never interested in or good at sport. You know, I think a lot of designers lead quite healthy lives who, you know, they play football with mates at the weekend or, you know, I don't know, play cricket or golf or play in a band or sing or do whatever, you know. I think it's good to have something else. But it just never happened with me.
So this isn't one I wrote in on the email, but I've been asking people as of recently when I realize I haven't even introduced myself. I'm Brian. I did it in the email, I know, but I'm a graphic design student from Stoke-on-Trent. I started this last year. I've interviewed a few people. The last one I did, I interviewed Paul Scheer. The last one before that, I did Malcolm Garrett. I'm kind of collecting, like, you're like Pokemon at this point. But if you could, so the question is, if you could pick one thing that you think has been really pivotal in developing your own career, one thing, be it anything, it might be a stupid question given the questions that we've just been talking about, but so anything, you know, a book, a movie, a piece of music, a person, whatever, if you could pick one thing which you think has been the sort of the heartbeat of your career, let's say, really you know, it was a pivotal thing. What do you think it would be? If you can't answer it, I can just leave this.
No, it's okay. I mean, I think in some ways, probably the most, well, okay, two things. One was becoming interested in the work of, and especially the pedagogical work of Paul Klee when I was an art student. And in 1976, when I got my grant, I impoverished, I broke my budget by buying the two volumes of the Paul Klee notebooks in hardback by Lund Humphreys, which were originally published in, don't know, quite a long time ago. It's like, yes, before 76. That might have been the first English edition still in print. It had been published in Switzerland or Germany sort of 10 years prior to that. But these are just two amazingly beautiful and brilliant books in English translated about Klee's philosophy and approach to nature and structure and drawing and the relationship between, you know, the surface of the page or the canvas or the paper and, you know, art itself, if you like. And then the other foundational experience was when I was in my final year at art school in Corsham. The head of department was a guy called Benno Zender, and he was at Swiss, and he'd been in the UK since, I think, 67 or 68, and he was running the visual communication program at Bath. And he used to go back to Switzerland during the summer, you know, to visit and stuff. And this particular year, he came back with a couple of Weingart's Kunstkredit posters, I think the 1976 and 1977 versions. And these felt format posters, which are pretty huge, and they were framed in the kind of foyer of the main kind of building on the studio campus. And I walked in first day back in final year to go for a tutorial with Benno and saw these two posters, and I just never seen anything like it before in terms of the space and depth and texture and the typographic language. So I suppose, don't know, those two were quite quite life-changing things, I suppose. And that's why I ended up going to Basel in the end, to talking to Benno about the course there. And so I applied, got a place, and I had to work for a year to get a scholarship. I worked for a year while I got a scholarship together, and went the year after I left art school to do the one-year postgrad thing.
Wait, just a random question, but from what I've gathered, are you religious at all?
Oh, God, no. Sorry.
It's just the way that you talk. It's almost like you're a graphic design monk, and I don't mean that as an insult, but do you get where I'm coming from? Sort of devoting yourself to it in that sense.
Yeah, no, I'm totally agnostic and atheist, and I've never believed in any god or gods.
I'm just curious, that's all. Also, something I did ask that come up while you were talking, that I thought, would you consider your work underrated?
It doesn't. I can't answer that question. It kind of doesn't matter. I know most of it's shit.
It's lovely.
No, well, I mean, yeah, but you can never be that happy with what you've done, you know. I mean, and it's always about the next job anyway. You're only as good as your next job. I can see what's wrong with all of it. But also, don't forget.
Do you sit and pick things apart after you've done it?
Not necessarily, but I think one important thing to say, and something that we haven't discussed so far, is that it's not really me. It's 8VO was, you know, three people at the start, and then two people, and then three again. Muir McNeil is another collaborative thing, you know, And it's not Paul and I who are credited with the work. It's the collaboration. And that's a really important thing to state, actually. And I don't like very much working completely on my own, you know. I'd much rather work with other people who share a... Because you end up doing stuff that none of you could have done on your own, you know. And it's there's some kind of energy about collaboration which is incredibly... it's just really exciting because you never know where it's going to lead. And if you respect the other people you're working with, it's incredible because you know, literally somebody suggests something and that suggests something else. And it's like you can end up covering so much more ground and, you know, taking so many different routes than you ever could navigate on your own, I think. And that was going to actually come to my answer to your question about what piece of advice would you give to a graduating student. And that would be it. I would say try not to work on your own. Try to, even if you are working for somebody else, you know, maybe meet with friends from college after you've both left and just talk about design, you know, and talk about what your approach is and what you believe in and what you think is good and what you think is bad and why you think it's good or bad. And don't try and be... So I think collaboration and cooperation are really important things. And I think it's a way of... I think you develop more as a designer working like that anyway, because you're not limited by your own limitations, which is a bit of a tautology, but you know, you've got other, it's a catalyst thing, you know, catalytic thing, where the conversation and the shared endeavor produces things that you could never produce alone.
And then I guess last one, I've got quite a lot here anyway, we've been going for half hour. So you did a piece in 1990 where with the BBC, where you set out a manifesto for the future of design with 8VO.
It wasn't really, it wasn't necessarily about the future of design. It was just about our own opinions. But yes, okay, yeah.
But I don't know if this question works then. But I guess the things that you were presenting, do you think they came true in a larger sense? And if you were to write one now, what would it change in a sense, the things that you would write now?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. I only ever sat through about, I forget how long it was, 12 minutes or something, but I couldn't watch it. I turned the telly off before it got to the end. It's just so excruciatingly embarrassing. And there were hours and hours of, I think we were filming there for 3 days solid, and you know, it's all in the edit. I don't really think we're very clear about what, you know, we banged on about a few things that we didn't like, but I don't think we were offering much of an alternative. And now if I was asked to write a manifesto, I'd say, no, I couldn't possibly do that because I don't believe in them. You know,
that's fair. I think that's pretty much it.
Okay.
The last question is, if people listening wanted to find yourself online, have you got any websites and things like that you can direct them to?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna, it's pointless giving you the URL for mine because it's the site is, there's something wrong with it at the moment and I've got to get it fixed. So there's Muir McNeil, which is muirmcneil.com, and there's Muir McNeil have an Instagram account, at Muir McNeil. And Mark and I run a Instagram account for 8VO, which is called 8VO_Octavo. And that's kind of, it's like an archive of the work.
It's very lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's pretty much it then.
Hello, it is I. I hope you enjoyed listening to that. And yeah, I shall see you whenever. I'll say next time. I don't think I want to say next time because I don't know when the gap is going to be between these now, because obviously there was quite a gap between this one and the last one, wasn't there? Which I've just realised now. Yeah, I'll see you when I see you, I guess. I will not see you. You'll hear me. I don't know. Shut up. Bye.